Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey. Today, we've got our live audience from the Upgrade Collective in the house. We've got lots of people in because this is going to be a really powerful episode. If you'd like to be in the live audience, be able to ask questions, go to ourupgradecollective.com and join my private membership group where I'm teaching all of my books and all of my knowledge with a team of coaches, super structured, to answer all your questions and teach you how to be bulletproof. Today is an episode that I've wanted to do for a long time, and it's hard to get this guy on as a guest. He's a director of the Longevity Institute at USC, the Leonard Davis School of Gerontology, director of the Longevity and Cancer Program at the IFOM, the Italian Foundation for Cancer Research. And he was named by Time in 2018 as one of the 50 most influential people in healthcare for his research on fasting-mimicking diets as a way to improve health and prevent disease. He wrote a famous book called The Longevity Diet. I'm talking about none other than Professor Valter Longo. Valter, welcome to the show.
Thanks, David. Good to be on it.
I've called you multiple times when I'm talking about fasting and answering questions about it and all as sort of the godfather of fasting. And one of the things one of the reasons I say that is that you've spent so many years looking at fasting way ahead of the curve. Why did fasting come into your lens so early compared to almost everyone else alive? Where'd the original inspiration come from?
Yeah, I think two things mostly. UCLA, so I went to UCLA because Roy Walford was there, right? So in Roy Walford, back in the days, in the early 90s, he was in Biosphere 2, and he was basically doing the first human color restriction experiment. And he was a pathologist, a medical doctor at UCLA. And at the time, he was the most famous person in the world for, let's say, nutrition and longevity, right, and aging. And so certainly Roy was a big influence. And then the other part was the other lab that I worked on at UCLA, which was first Steve Clark and then John Valentine. And with Steve Clark, I worked on starving bacteria. And with John Valentine, I worked on starving yeast, you know. And I don't know, I was interested in that maybe because of the Walford influence. And so every time I got an opportunity, I was really infatuated by the starvation and the effects, of course, that I was observing early on. So the bacteria, you starve them, they become long-lived or much longer-lived, and they become very resistant. And the yeast, you starve them, same thing, long-lived and very resistant to all kinds of toxins. And so when I saw bacteria and yeast responding the same way and then connecting with Roy Walford, he was not working on fasting. He was working on calorie restriction. But I think, you know, I made the connection, and I knew this was a very powerful, 3 billion years old, function that was poorly understood. And keep in mind, everybody was making fun of this right, at the time, right? Everybody thought it was a joke. Like, well, why would you possibly work on starving bacteria and yeast? It's just the most boring thing ever. So that was the attitude back in those days.
Do you like to be seen more as a longevity researcher or as a fasting researcher?
Yeah, I think longevity, and not just longevity, but what I call youth span and juventology, right? So how do you stay young? And then once you cannot stay young anymore, once a youth span period is over, how do you stay healthy? And that's the health span program. Fasting is really, in my mind, is probably the most powerful way to reset and help regenerate, but also help clear junk and damage that is accumulated.
How often do you fast?
First of all, I always start by saying fasting doesn't mean anything, right? Fasting is like saying eating. How often do you eat? So I think that the answer is every day, right? So every day I do 12 hours, about 12 hours of fasting and 12 hours of feeding. And then maybe once a year I would do a fasting-mimicking diet, a 5-day fasting-mimicking diet. Sometimes I may do it twice a year, depending on underneath. But mostly, I follow my diet, what I described in the book, the longevity diet. And so I think we're seeing a lot of evidence in the lab that, you know, for the very few that follow this very precise type of diet, the fasting mimicking diet doesn't have to be done as much, right? So the average person may do it 3 or 4 times a year. But I think that for somebody that has an ideal diet, maybe once or twice a year is sufficient.
Okay, so if you eat the right stuff, then once or twice a year, you do a longer fast. And it's permissible to have something during the fast as long as you're getting your macros right.
Yeah,
because you're still maintaining autophagy.
Yeah, it's not just eating the right stuff. I think it's the timing, it's the frequency, is whatever else you do, you know, the exercise, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's lifestyle, mostly nutrition, but not only nutrition. And so, yeah, if you do all the right things, then probably that's sufficient. Yeah.
A lot of the research I've seen says that 12 hours is the very minimum effective length of a fast for increasing ketosis over time. Dr. Murad from Australia has done some studies on alternate day 12-hour intermittent fasting and seen slight increases in ketones. But a lot of the research I've seen lately is looking more at 16 hours without food. That seems to be where a lot of people end up, and occasionally going longer. For me, it's been 24 hours since I ate anything, and I'm not hungry, and I guess I'm going to force myself to eat because I don't want to do a two-day fast. But why 12, not 14? Is there a specific reason for that?
Yes, there is. So if you look at, I always say I could never find a negative study under 12 and 12, right? Mm-hmm. But I found many negative studies on the 16 hour. One of them, multiple of them are having to do with gallstone formation. You know, people that fast for 16, 18 hours a day tend to have twice as much bladder operations as people that fast for 10 or 12 hours. And also, I'm concerned about the now 4 or 5 studies showing that people that skip breakfast live shorter, right? And have more cardiovascular disease, and now a new study showing more cancer. So, you know, of course, these are epidemiological studies, there are associations. But at the same time, I always say if, you know, most people that skip breakfast will say fast for 14, 16, 18 hours. If that was so beneficial, why isn't counterbalancing whatever negative these people may be doing? So maybe they're not living shorter because of the fasting. But why is the fasting, if it's positive, not making them live normal, right? And that's a concern, yeah. Right?
It's always a question, you know, are people who skipping breakfast because they're too tweaked or too busy or, you know, going to work or they're having a cigarette? And I think they account for cigarette smoking usually in most of these. But is it an unhealthy lifestyle choice because their people aren't caring for themselves, or is it conscious fasting?
Yeah. And so my point is,
it's hard to tell.
Why is the fasting not helping them against whatever other bad lifestyle they might have? Right.
Yeah.
That's my point. So that you figure that if it was so powerful to do 16 hours a day, then it should take care of, and they'll live at least a normal life. They wouldn't have a shorter life, right? The concern is when you see shorter, right? So yeah, that's when you say, that's very surprising, right? If it was so good for you, why don't we see them at least living normal?
Got it. And it could be that if they ate breakfast, they'd be even worse off, but we don't really know because of epidemiology. It's a tough one.
Right.
So exactly.
Yeah. We don't know, but the question is,
it's a fair question.
You know, how much you want to risk, considering these studies, considering the gallbladder operation, considering also that most centenarians don't do 16, 18 hours. So this is why in my book, I always talk about a 5-pillar approach. And try to get the common denominator. What is the common between all? What do they all support, right? So if you look at centenarians, 12 hours is very common.
Is there a difference in the length of fast that's appropriate based on your age?
Well, again, it depends on what fasting you're talking about. I think that the 5-day fasting mimicking diet, as we're testing clinically, we think it's appropriate until age 65 to 70. Then it does not mean it's not appropriate anymore, let's say, to do it 3 times a year. We now have an ongoing clinical trial on Alzheimer's patients, and so they're fine. So far, they're doing okay. They're doing fine. So, you know, they're much older than 65. Some of them are in their 80s. So it doesn't mean they cannot do it, but right now we just don't have enough data to do this long fast in the 70 and older, let's say. Then if you're talking about intermittent fasting, again, you know, if you do 12 hours, it's perfectly fine. There is really no reason to stop at any age. In fact, that might be very healthy even for a 100-year-old person. If you're looking at other forms of fasting, I think I would put it in the same category. Let's say that somebody does 2 days a week or 1 day a week. I would put it in the same category as the fasting mimicking diet, meaning that, you know, to do 1 day a week of a 24-hour fast, I would not recommend that to somebody who's 75 years old.
I agree with that assessment. I found one person who's 81 who's been doing about a 14 to 16 hour fast every day for 59 years. She does not look like she's 81. Her brain is totally sharp. Her name's Margaret Paul. She was just on the show. Does a lot of work more around emotional and psychological trauma. But you know, when you look at the few people we can find who've practiced it, it seems that there's something going on that's really beneficial.
Right. But if you, I mean, we're starting to think of a standard or an FDA like standard, right? Yeah. And then if you have an FDA like standard, if you think about that, it's like saying, you know, if you give a vaccine to a few people, they've done pretty well. Can we give it to the whole world, right? No. Well, we need 70,000 people, right?
Yeah, we do.
So yeah, that's the same. The same is true here. And unfortunately, the epidemiological studies, when you do 70,000 people or 700,000 people, they show a shorter lifespan, right? So for the biggest group that we can find doing 16 hours, that's why you have to say, wait a minute, you know, what am I, even though it could be beneficial to a lot of people, what if it's detrimental to even more people than it is beneficial to? And this is very typical for most of the traditional things. You know, if you look at something that's very old, it usually tend to do lots of good in one sense and lots of bad, right? And that's why they never quite stick around. And so, yeah, then we need to find, how do you get, and this is calorie restriction, for example. Say, calorie restriction that Roy Walford used to study has been around for 100 years. And if you look at it now, they used to say fantastic things about calorie restriction back in the 70s. How many people do calorie restriction right now? Almost nobody.
Like and, 20.
almost nobody, right? So, but why? Well, because even the monkey studies after Richard Weindruck, somebody else that was in Roy Walford's lab, he did the 25-year-long study, realized that, you know, there is lots of positive and lots of negative. So if you look at cholesterol, blood pressure, fasting glucose, amazing results, right? And then the monkey may drop dead after anesthesia. And you're thinking, wow, how is it possible? What happened that in calorie restriction that makes somebody so sensitive to anesthesia? But so the age-related disease caused that. We're much affected by the lifelong calorie restriction, but then the overall survival was not that much improved. When they did the same study at the NIA, the National Institute on Aging, it wasn't improved at all, right? There was no difference in survival. Yeah, so that's the type of thinking that we try to put together to then come up with what's very safe for people and at the same time can make them live to 110 healthy.
Do you think we're going to get to the point where you look at your genes or you look at your gut bacteria or some mix of markers from the blood and go, oh, for you, you should do X amount of fasting or this is your ideal eating window? Is that even conceivable?
Oh, it's very much conceivable. And I think no more than 5 years ahead of us. So yeah, absolutely. That's already done for, you know, should you eat this or that? And so I will imagine soon enough, we'll have enough data associating or correlating a certain profile of microbiota with the response or lack thereof to fasting. So we're already collecting this, for example, for multiple sclerosis trial, we're collecting microbiota. The cancer trial, we're collecting microbiota. The Alzheimer trial, we're collecting a microbiota. The IBD trial, I'm sure we're also doing that. So I think it's just a matter of time before we have enough data that we can say the non-responders happen to have this profile, you know, and at some point, I think artificial intelligence is going to have to help us do it because it's just going to be lots of data that are extremely difficult to analyze the classical way.
Are there private companies that you've seen that are working on that problem, or is this all university and government funded?
I know, I don't want to mention the name of the company because I don't know if they want me to mention it, but I know even years ago we were approached by a private company looking for the data. So I will assume there are many already that are looking at intermittent fasting, periodic fasting, et cetera, and they're starting to collect data that eventually they will analyze to distinguish the responders from the non-responders.
Well, I'm looking forward to that day. I would love to be able to sit down and look at someone's stack of hormones and thyroid and everything else, plug it into an AI engine and say, you know, eat for X amount this day and maybe even what to eat. And I know there's a bunch of people working on it. So I was hoping you'd tell us the coolest ones, but I understand there's NDAs in place and all.
Yeah, no, and I don't know if they have, I don't think they have it as a service yet, right? So I don't think they're at the point that that they can give it to the public. So So that's the main reason why I don't want to mention it. If I knew it was publicly available, I would mention it. But I'm not sure. I don't think it is.
I get it. Yeah, don't throw a company in hot water with thousands of people calling them all at once when you can't buy what they have. But when you know, send me a note and I'll definitely talk with them. What did you learn from yeast that translated best into human aging in your labs?
So everything we do is based on yeast research. Yeah, so I think we forget that this is as old as we are, meaning like we all come from the same organisms and we've evolved in parallel with the yeast. And so we obey the same rules they obey. We have the same what's called force of natural selection. For example, all our work that we do on cancer started in yeast, and the discovery that the genes that were, if you starve a yeast, the same genes that are proto-oncogenes, so the ones that are involved in cancer, are the ones that prevent the protection, right? So remember earlier I said the yeast, you starve it, becomes very protected of all kinds of toxins. Well, if you have an oncogene, which most cancers have in them, that oncogene prevents the protection, right? So that's the first observation was, well, if now by having this type of gene like RAS, if you have RAS that is always on, and if that prevents the cancer cell from becoming resistant, then this is a way to distinguish all cancer cells from all normal cells. So all normal cells, including bacteria, by the way, will respond to starvation in a coordinated manner and it'll go into the starvation response mode. The only disobedient cells are going to be the cancer cells, right? So, yeah. So then it will all the way to clinical trials, and now even successful clinical trials. So I think everything. So we discovered the torus kinase pathway in yeast, and that was the first. Now everybody talks about rapamycin and TOR in aging. We discovered it thanks to yeast, and when we did screen, and it was a screen, meaning that. We basically mutated all the genes in the DNA of the yeast, right? It's say most of the 6,000. And then we asked the question, which mutations make the yeast live longer? And one thing kept coming up, and it was something called SCH9. And SCH9 is what TOR regulates. And, that's what rapamycin, the drug rapamycin that is now so famous for aging research, is blocking, right? So there was not something that we even thought about. It was the yeast that told us, focus on this, because this is the most important thing that you can block to extend life. And in fact, once we combine the mutation in that gene and in the, I call that the protein pathway, the amino acid pathway. And there's a sugar pathway, which is PKA. So once we have two mutations in these two genes in yeast, and then we also starve them, we extend the lifespan by tenfold, right? So we make the organism 10 times longer lived than the normal ones, right? So again, yeast pointed to all the right directions.
And today, like you said, mTOR and rapamycin are all the rage. And certainly that original discovery that you had led, longtime listeners have heard me talk about, tripling down things that suppress mTOR so it can come back up later. Like, you know very well, fasting and coffee and exercise suppress mTOR. So just thanks for doing that work. I think it's led to all kinds of innovations in understanding and nutrition and anti-aging and exercise. And it's really foundational work, which is really cool.
Thanks.
Now, I have some more questions. In my book on aging, I had seven pillars of aging, like things that we know, pathways we want to maintain so we can be youthful. And in your book, you had this concept of pillars as well, but you had five pillars of longevity. Can you walk me through those five pillars so people who hear the show can get a sense of how you're looking at aging? Because you've studied it for 30 years. I want to know.
Yeah. So, I mean, one is for sure the genetics of aging and the basic research, like what I just mentioned, right? So what controls the lifespan of all organisms? And is there a longevity program? And can you switch that program? Because now you take advantage of what I call 3 billion years of research and development. And you basically say the organism already have something, an alternative program that they can go to that can already extend the lifespan. So the question is, how do you get in there? Like, is there like an hibernation-like state for humans that you can switch to? And how do you get in there, right? Or is there a regenerative mode in humans that you can get to, and how do you get there? So the basic organisms and the research on longevity in this, what we call model organisms, is very essential. The other one is, of course, epidemiology, right? So studies of a large population, what I was mentioning earlier, what happens to people that fast for a certain number of hours, whereas, you know, a few years ago we published on protein, what happens to the Americans that eat low protein versus those that eat high protein, and is there an age-specific effect? You know, and so we published that, yeah, the low protein was better up to a certain age, but not after 65. Then after 65, the moderate protein intake was better.
Thank you for that study, by the way. That was part of the recommendations in my anti-aging book. It was based on, and I did reference your study in the book. Done.
Yeah,
good
yeah,
finding.
Thanks. And so that epidemiology, large population, because then you bring in the math, right? The ability to do statistics and use math to make conclusions. Then clinical trial, randomized clinical trial. Like I always cite the one by Astruc and colleagues in Spain. You know, you take 7,000 people, you put them in either a low-fat diet, and there's always been this fight, right? Low-fat versus high-fat. And so there's 7,000 people either on a low-fat diet or on a high olive oil and nuts diet, and you wait 5 years, and then you say, you know, in that case, they showed that the olive oil and nut consuming people had less heart attacks and live longer. So that's a very good study to publish in the New England Journal of Medicine, by the way, that tells you maybe a very low-fat diet, if it is olive oil, is not such a good idea for people that have cardiovascular disease or are high risk for cardiovascular disease. And another pillar is the centenarians, right? So what if you go to Okinawa or in certain regions of southern Italy, whether it's Sardinia or Calabria or Loma Linda or lots of other places, you know, what do they do? What do they eat that makes them get to 100 so frequently? So I think that's probably one of the most important pillars, just because it brings in, I think, a major safety factor, right? So if all this population have this in common, so if most of them or all of them have a vegan plus fish or a vegan plus a little bit of meat diet, it probably is not bad for you, right? At least we can say that. Now, did they make him live to 100? Well, it's more complicated than that. Most of them seem to have, regardless of the stories we hear, most of them seem to have a genetic component, right? So they have the right diet, but they also genetically predisposed to get to a very long lifespan.
Yeah. A guy who's been on the show, James Clements, flew around and collected genetic data from 100 and something people who are all over 100 to get the genetics into a lab to be able to figure out what are some common genetic markers there that's been influential. I forget who he worked with on that, but there's definitely a genetic component. Have you seen the studies that say the other component is poor record keeping and high taxes in some of those areas, that there's some amount of fraud?
Yeah, yeah. Most areas, actually. I have a large amount of fraud. I always remember the Vilcabamba. You know, everybody used to ask me, oh, what about Vilcabamba in Ecuador? And then I finally sent some journalists, and this was world famous for the centenarians. But then I was talking to my colleagues because we do research in Ecuador, and they said, you know, this is all made up. And so the people there will tell the journalists whatever they want to hear so that the journalists keep coming. So I sent some people from the television, from an Italian television, to check, and there was not a single centenarian in Vilcabamba. Right? So this is very, very common that people exaggerate. They may take the identity of their father or uncle, you know, for whatever reasons, right? And maybe to get their pension.
And, yeah, inheritance and then, taxes and whatever.
Yeah, then, or inherit whatever. And yeah, so I think it's very, very common.
And it still doesn't say we shouldn't study people who are actually older. And there's some pretty well-validated ones where my perspective is that there's at least one person that we are pretty darn sure is 120 years old. So that's our current, basically, top level. And like, how do we beat that over the next 100 years so that that becomes more of a mid-level? If you put on your hat 100 years from now, how old do you think the oldest person on Earth will be?
That's a tough question. I think that, fortunately, I think technology is going to take over in the next 50 years. And I think bionics is going to take over in the next 50 years. And I think it's going to be a very different world. I don't even think that. And I could be wrong, you know, usually it takes us longer to get there. So it may be 200 years and not 100. But I don't even think right now, whatever we're doing is going to be that relevant for 200 years from now. I think it's going to be a very different approach, right? It's going to be an approach that it has to do much more with memory and memory transfer and all kinds of crazy things, you know, but, yeah, I imagine that's a world of 100 to 200 years from now. It's not the world that you know. It's not going to be modifying Tor or PKA. It could be that one of us identifies a way to reprogram. You know, I always say, can you reprogram a mouse to make it live as long as a naked mole rat? I say,
yeah, my favorite spirit animal. Right?
Yeah, so you go from 2 to 3 years to 30 years. Yeah, that's possible, right? That's possible that we can turn some of the programs on, and those programs could revolutionize a lifespan. But I think it'd be in parallel with some of the more crazy science fiction things that are unavoidably gonna happen.
So you're thinking the oldest living person 100 plus years from now will be a cyborg?
I think that I would be shocked if in 30 or 40 years, where most people are, before we die, are not going to be part human and in part something else, right? And we already have that, right? So the pancreas and all kinds of artificial hearts, right? So yeah. So we already have a lot of that. And it's just hard for me to, and I'm not endorsing it, but I think it's hard to imagine that that we're not going to use that more and more and more. It's much easier to build things, right? And now, of course, when you get to a brain or a liver, it's much more complicated. But for sure, even in the next 50 years, I think that we're going to see a lot of bionics and a lot of parts being introduced. And, you know, rightfully so. I mean, if somebody is waiting for a kidney transplant, why not use an artificial kidney? You know? And I imagine that technology every year is going to get better and better. And so,
Seem concerned, though. Like, for better or worse, I hear a lot of trepidation in your voice. What's scary about that to you?
Well, you know, I think it's the abandoning who we are, right? So and that's gotta be a scary thing to anybody, right? And then you wanna as we're as we are, you know, investing in technology, we have to ask the question, is all this technology, I mean, the atomic bomb, right? So, but the atomic bomb in a small, like a very small example compared to what this could be, right? This would be much, much worse, right? So that's what I'm worried about, right? Where we, our inability for the first time in history to control where it goes, right? Not so much what we can do with it, but are we going to be in control of it? And that's the scary part, right?
Personally, I hope Facebook's in control of it so that my ocular implants can get malware. Wouldn't that be great?
Maybe if it was Facebook, maybe. But you know, as systems are starting to learn, you know, to self-learn, you can only control that up to a certain point, right? And at some point, that self-learning process is going to take into something that can decide for itself, right?
And that's so you're worried about Skynet.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm worried about, you know, human beings losing control of the technology and the technology being in charge of the technology, right? So that's my big concern. Yeah.
Well, coming out of Silicon Valley as an actual computer hacker, one of the reasons that I named it biohacking is that generally hackers are the people who try to take back control from the big companies. You know, we have Linux and open source operating systems, which run most of the internet now, not closed source big companies. And I'm hopeful the future of biohacking is relatively transparent because we have a community of people who are paying attention to these things. And I'm still hopeful about a positive future, but yeah, it could go dark. I'm 100% with you, Walter.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and I'm not, and great. I mean, that's exactly what we need. We need a lot more of that, right? So who's regulating this and what is going to be our plan to fight this, right? So to make sure it doesn't go that way or it goes in a positive way and not in a we lost control way.
Yeah. And we've got to define our humanity so that we can maintain it. And it's such a mushy concept right now that, you know, being able to decide what that means and what we want it to mean. And these are huge philosophical questions that go beyond just life extension. So I love it that you're thinking about this in the context of longevity. In fact, it's really refreshing to hear where your mind is on it.
Well, I mean, I come as an 18-year-old that wanted to live forever, right? I mean, that's how I got started, right? And then, you know, I always say I heard the story, but I never heard it from Roy Walford. But I heard he was going to freeze himself, and then I heard he also took himself off the list to be frozen, right? So at some point, Walford, like myself, you know, went from I want to live forever to I'm not sure anymore, So I don't know why and if that's a correct story, but that's what I was told, and so. I wouldn't be surprised if it's true, and that he went from that state of mind to a very different state of mind as he was getting in his 60s and 70s.
I have often said that I'm going to live to at least 180, but the reality is I'd like to die at a time and by a method of my choosing. So if I'm done, I'm done, and I have the freedom to do that.
Right. Sure. I mean, and I'm the same way, of course. You know. So yeah, I would definitely like to have that option, but. But it's just, I think that it can get more complicated than we appreciate. But certainly, yeah, 180, I think it would be something that most people will say yes to. I always remember I asked my mother, right, maybe 20 years ago. And I said, she's very religious. And I said, well, would you want to live to, I forget what it was, 200 or something like that. And I was sure that she was going to say, no way, you know, because of the religion. And she said, of course, you know. And then she said, you know, because I'll be able to see your kids grow up. And, you know, so that was really interesting, you know, from such a religious person to hear that she will want to live to 200 because of, you know, feeling like she's living now when maybe she's got four or five generations that she can watch and then she's ready to go. So, you know.
I'm really hopeful, Walter, that the longevity movement, and you've played a major role in it, but it's going to enable us to have an epidemic of wisdom where we have people who've been around long enough to have figured out a lot of the stuff in life, like you're saying Roy did as he aged, where we attain some wisdom, we learn some things, and we have enough energy to share it so that we can maybe steer the ship a little bit better than we have before. Because if, you know, people start losing their faculties in their, you know, late 60s, right when you probably figured life out when you were 16. And then, you know, you don't have much time to pass that on. So we end up doing these, you know, waves of change that doesn't always go in the right direction. But if we have people who are, hey, you know, we've seen this three times before, it's all right. Here's how we're going to navigate it. It feels like we could actually do a better job as a species. I mean, do you look at longevity as, you know, maybe a something that's going to support the planet versus put a further burden on it?
Yeah, I think that there is no doubt. I always talk about 110 healthy, and Roy was used to talk about 120 healthy. So I think it's a very good goal, you know, to get, you know, if we could get, and I always say, I don't think we're going to get the planet to be 110 healthy. I think we're going to get the people that follow all the things they should follow to get to 110 on average healthy, right? So that's a goal, right? A lot of people are going to keep smoking and doing whatever they want, and they're just going to probably keep about what they got already right now. But then I think that, for the group that wants to get there, there's going to be ways to do it. And, you know, and of course, some people are going to die earlier, some people are going to die later. But that is reasonable to start thinking about 110 average lifespan with most of it lived healthy as a goal.
Do you ever get life insurance companies who call you and say, I want the data so that we can actually figure out who we should or shouldn't sell life insurance to? Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of six different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
They don't call me, but they are certainly working with us. I think now, at least some of the biggest ones are starting to work with us in starting to getting aligned with the patient's health, right? More the health insurance company than the life insurance companies. But so I think that, yeah, so that's the life insurance companies are also aligned with the health insurance companies, I would say. But we're starting to work with the health insurance companies in looking at how to, instead of reimbursing whatever problem, disease, cost somebody has, can we avoid that? Can we think about, you know, getting to 100 healthy or 110 healthy? And in the past, surprisingly, it wasn't like that, right? So the health insurance companies were working on, were just reimbursing whatever it cost and charging people for it, right? So now I think that's moving, and soon enough we'll move more into, here's what we reimburse, and if you can keep everybody healthy, then you can be, you know, wealthier as a clinic or as a doctor, and keep more of the funds. Yeah.
I love that. I'm really hopeful that we start getting a more normal and science-based situation there. I bought some life insurance a few years ago, and they're like, we're not going to sell you life insurance. I'm like, why not? I said, well, you had this really advanced cardiac risk profile done. I said, yeah, but it showed that I was healthy. And they're like, yeah, but you must be worried about something because you got the lab data. I'm not worried about anything. I'm tracking my progress. So we were coming from very different worlds, and they finally did give me a policy. But it took, you know, a lot of banging around and sort of aggressive maneuvering so they would do it. And I feel like in the future, maybe they'll look at the actual data versus some sort of mythical tables from the 50s, which is,
yeah, I mean, of course, a lot of people are resistant to that, right? So a lot of people don't want them to look at the data, right? So that especially in the United States, they're not going to have an easy time in doing that. But I think they certainly want to do that, right? And both health insurance and life insurance companies.
I guess the trick is for some sort of health insurance or some life insurance company based in Mauritius or somewhere where there's no regulation to just sell out of country policies based on real data to people. I like that idea. Somebody start that company and sell me good life insurance that's actually going to be there. There we go. We'll just get around the regulation.
Now, yeah, certainly it could be going the other way around. It could be that the very healthy people now go decide to release the data, right? Because that's the biggest problem. Once the very healthy people, so let's say the ones that invest in all the longevity intervention, they could say, or can we find a, or form even an insurance company that just treats us because we're okay releasing the data, right? So if the group was okay releasing the data, then I think most insurance companies will probably go for it because to them it's just numbers. If they know you have a much higher risk, then a much lower risk, then they don't mind lowering the premium.
That's a good point. I'm hoping that the data from your lab eventually makes its way into our decision making in a broader way. Right now, individually, we can use it, but to use it for the systems of society is one of the things I hope is of benefit for the future. So, something else you've said in your book that made me really happy was you said, without understanding how nutrients such as proteins and sugars affect cellular function, aging and aging damage and regeneration, it's difficult to determine the type and quantity of nutrients for optimal longevity. What have you learned about the type and quantity of nutrients that are important in different types of fats, different types of proteins, different types of carbs? Like what has come out of your science that tells us different carbs do different things and things like that?
Yeah, so we learned a lot, right? So we can now usually go down to, let's say, a specific amino acid, or we can define, for example, in our cancer studies, we define what the level of sugar needs to be lower to for the cancer to start suffering. And we're also starting to distinguish between different type of cells and what cell needs what, right? So, so the mechanisms, before you can get something approved by the FDA, you have to have mechanisms, and here's no different, right? So if you don't understand the mechanisms, you're really walking in the dark. And so, because we know that, say, proteins control growth hormone, releasing hormone, which controls growth hormone, controls IGF-1, but the protein also controls the levels of insulin and they control insulin sensitivity. But then within the protein, it's not just about protein, it's about the amino acid profile.
Right.
Different amino acid profile can have completely different effect. So you can have 100 grams of protein that are biosimilar to 20 grams of protein, depending on the source, right? And depending on what you're going after. So it's, the same is true for fats, what type of fats. And not just in a simple way, because again, you have 100 different types of cells, let's say, they can respond 100 different ways, right? So a liver cell can respond to something the opposite way as a muscle cell responds, right? So now if you're using the liver cell, maybe it's producing IGF-1 and insulin, and the muscle cell is responding to IGF-1 and insulin. So they have to have a very different role. And yeah, so this systems biology approach is really fundamental. If we don't use it, then we're just going to be lost, right? And I think soon enough, this is why I really am a promoter of the team of doctors together with molecular biologists. I mean, the clinic, my foundation has a clinic here in Los Angeles. We have one in Italy. And I think our approach has been like that. You have a molecular biologist, you have a physician, you have a dietitian, and the rest of the medical team. And they work together because now I think the systems biology is so complex that the doctor couldn't possibly try to handle all of this, including, let's say, microbiota, metabolomics. But just the strategizing based on, if you just look at the blood test from a regular doctor, that already has an immense level of information about that patient that if you really bring it into systems biology understanding, you can come up with the opposite treatment for that person than a doctor will come up with. So, for example, lots of doctors will say, put somebody on metformin. And then metformin, sulfonylurea, and then eventually insulin, right? So, of course, in our clinic, the doctor tries to do the opposite, just get you off all, if you are a metformin, is there a way working with the endocrinologist, we can get you back to non-needy metformin? And, you know, are, is there something that we can do to unlock that insulin resistance that was generated? And, you know, is it because of the fat, the liver in the fat in the liver? Is it because of the fat in the visceral area? And, you know, how do we eliminate, not necessarily make you lose a lot of weight, but make you lose whatever is responsible for the generation of insulin resistance, right? Yeah. So I think that, yeah, systems biology and mechanisms are have to be in the next 5 years, I'm not talking about 50 years, yeah. In the next 5 years, they have to be at the center of decision making in the doctor's office.
I love your view and I share it. We're right on the cusp. Is, when it comes to metformin, many of my anti-aging friends go back to when the first studies came out that said metformin causes some genetic or epigenetic changes similar to what a calorie restriction diet does. I think in 2003, Biomarker Pharmaceuticals was out talking about this. I met with those guys and I took metformin for 3 years because I thought it was going to make me live a long time. And then I saw some other studies and felt some effects around mitochondrial suppression. What's your take on metformin or occasional use or regular use as an anti-aging substance? Are you for it or against it or?
Yeah, first of all, I'm very scared of Nir Barzilai because if I ever say anything negative on metformin, I get a call. Nir is a friend of mine at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and he's the person leading the big trial on the TAME study on metformin. Yeah, so I think if I had to pick two drugs, one would be rapamycin blocking TOR and one would be metformin blocking both TOR, by the way, and the PKA pathway, the sugar pathway, and the protein amino acid pathway. So I think I think there's a lot of potential. We just have to wait and see. And I think Nir is doing absolutely the right way. Basically saying there's enough data suggesting that this could be benefiting people. Let's do, you know, like the asterisk study, thousands of people. Mm-hmm. The danger is very low, and so we should be able to, like for the vaccines and everything else, we should be able to get a pretty good idea. Hopefully, of not only does it benefit people overall, but is there a subgroup of people that shouldn't take it, right? Because it may not benefit them at all, it might actually hurt them. So like you say, it's an inhibitor of mitochondrial respiration. It's an inhibitor of gluconeogenesis when the liver makes glucose, its own glucose, because the brain needs it. So you know what happens, for example, if you're doing intermittent fasting or periodic fasting and you're taking metformin, well, you could be in a lot of trouble, right?
Yeah.
And we've seen lots of mice dying like that. And the combination of fasting and metformin. And this is why in the clinical trials, you know, I'm always very, very scared of combining the two, whether it's cancer trial or diabetes trial that we're running. And we usually stop the metformin for the days that somebody's on a fasting. But yeah, as it goes out there, how many combinations are there on metformin plus that are negative or very negative as the one I just described? Maybe there is a 50 different things that you could do, and maybe they're not very common things to do, but like fasting is not necessarily very common, but it is becoming very common, right? And so now what if, you know, if you for 50 or 100 times you combine metformin with fasting, you end up, in the hospital, if not worse, right? So, yeah, wow. That's the thing that we have to think about. I think it's a good idea to do the research, and I think at some point I'd love to see maybe a form of rapamycin that does not cause hyperglycemia, because rapamycin unfortunately causes the blood glucose level to go up. So hopefully, some studies will be done trying to avoid this side effect of rapamycin.
It's interesting. I think that for people who want to use metformin, the likely lowest risk path is use it once or twice a week on days where you're not doing heavy exercise because it inhibits your ability to benefit from exercise, and don't do it on a day during a fast. And if you want to do that and get some benefits, there might be some in there, and that seems safe. I think taking it all the time for anti-aging is, I did do it for a while, but I don't think it's necessarily something we know enough about yet. But I think I'm in the minority of anti-aging extremists.
Yeah. Also, you have to think of something else. You know, whether it's rapamycin and targeting our own pathway, or metformin. I always was very scared about intervention at the core of life, right? Mm-hmm. So if you look at the TOR pathway and you look at the PKA pathway and the RAS pathway, I mean, they're at the center of everything, right? And so the question is, you know, I always think about, I have these car analogies. I love car analogies. So if you take a car and you say, why don't you just poke holes through it until, or block things, you know, I just randomly block things until I get something that gives me a benefit. But then the question would be, okay, you're probably going to find something like that, right? The question is, would you want to, let's say, block some electrical wire in the car for the life of the car? And what is the consequence of that? Or, you know, pipe. Take a pipe in the car and you block it. Well, I say, you know, you want to make a car better. You have to be better than the engineers that made it in the first place, right? So you want to take a car that is already sophisticated. You just don't block things. You go in and say, okay, I want to understand. I'm going to take 20 years to understand how this car was built, and then I'm going to improve it, right? But and I may get this effect that you will get by blocking the pipe, but also I will avoid the long-term consequence that the car is going to overheat, you know, 2 years from now and then blow up, right? Or you damage the engine. Yeah. So I'm very concerned about. I mean. Pharmacology is extremely sophisticated and extremely unsophisticated, right? It's extremely sophisticated because it's very hard to, you know, be able to find a drug that targets, let's say, TOR pathway or PKA or whatever. But it's very unsophisticated because it just goes in there and it just blocks it all, every cell type. So I think yours is a good suggestion. If you're going to have to go that way, try to, you know, don't block this pipe all the time. Try to let it work most of the time, and then once in a while, you can block it. But even that, like what you and I are saying, it's fairly unsophisticated. At some point, we want to know why exactly is metformin, you know, doing what it is doing, and how can you replace the metformin with something that does not have those type of side effects and dangers? So that's the question, you know. And I will argue that fasting, at least periodic fasting and some other forms of fasting, are starting to get in that category, right? They don't need to be done all the time. They can be done periodically, and they can achieve all of it or a lot of it without any side effects that we see. Eventually, we could see them. But I think by being very, very careful in the way we approach it. So, for example, if you look at our fasting mimicking diet, people say, you know, why don't you have less carbohydrates in there? Why don't you have less sugars? And I say, I don't want to have less sugars in there. I mean, it's very little sugar. But, you know, should we go even lower? I don't want to do that because I want to make sure that we don't have these back and forth extremes, right? Which, even though I don't have any evidence now for that they may hurt people in the long run, I'm afraid that one day we'll find that out. So I want to avoid the possibility. I don't want to put anybody out of 1,000, not even 1 in 1,000, in the situation where I say, you know, I should have thought about this. I should have thought about the fact that 1 person in 1,000, because, you know, if it's a, let's say, 10 million people, 1 in 1,000 is a lot of people. So that's how we're thinking that we should be sophisticated enough in the approach that nobody gets the side effects. And I think some of the side effects you see from these drugs are not going to be 1 in 1,000. I think they're going to be much, much higher.
The car analogy is really fitting. If you look back at the history of hacking, some of the first modern day hackers were people who would build hot rods. And they did this to get away from the cops during Prohibition in the US. So they would take a car, and that was relatively simple back then, and they would study it, and they'd figure out, how do I make it go faster? And then you fast forward. I used to, years ago, I had a BMW, and I had it serviced at the Dinan garage. Dinan makes racing cars. So you take your car into a racing car mechanic, and it is noticeably faster and better when they're done. These are the people who did the work right. But when you do that, you also have to be on an aggressive maintenance schedule for the car, because otherwise the car falls apart because you're running it hotter. And it feels like when we're doing more longevity work, that it does take more maintenance if you're going to be tweaking with pathways, but the returns are, you know, all the time you have more energy in a car that stops better and accelerates faster and all that. But if you don't do the right maintenance stuff, we don't get there. And I feel like to your point, systems biology is what's going to give us the maintenance schedule for our race car, whether it's a Honda or not.
Yeah.
Does that seem accurate?
It seems very accurate. But the problem, I think, is the sophistication. If you look at a car, it's extremely, extremely simple. Even the space shuttle, you know, is extremely simple compared to a human body. So when you got to go in and fix millions of components, if you think about it, then you have to say, right now, I better use something that has been around. So I always use the example of if you cut yourself, can you imagine if we had to repair a cut with technology? You know, then you have to bring in stem cells and you have to bring in epithelial cells, et cetera, et cetera. Instead of letting, you know, the body fix itself, and 2 weeks later you let the body do its job, and the wound is fixed, right? So yeah, so I think it's for the short term, and this is why I like so much fasting. We let those 3 billion years, and we let the programs develop in history do their job. We just have to learn how they work, so that we can point them in the right direction, right? So essentially, so this is why we could take a mouse and damage the pancreas and they become type 1 diabetic. And then we start the fasting mimicking diet refeeding, and we see that there is an embryonic-like program that starts. And these cells in the pancreas are turned into, you know, the same type of cells that were there when the mouse was first born, and they start regenerating the pancreas, right? And it's really... an incredible a program, but you know, imagine if we had to do that with technology, just by inserting all the cells. Wow. I mean, you're looking at a 50-year project just to get what we were able to do with the fasting mimicking diet and refeeding.
I love that analogy. Yeah, it would be so challenging to re-engineer that, but we're going to get there. It's just a question of when. Right, let's go into a couple audience questions. The Upgrade Collective is a group of people who are really interested in biohacking, and they've studied my books, or they are studying my books, and it's a vibrant community. So I'm really stoked on these questions. What we'll do is you and I will be quiet while Diane asks her questions so we don't get any echoes. And then once she's done, we'll put her on mute and then we'll answer it. Diane, you ready to go?
I'm ready. Can you hear me? Are you okay? Can you both hear me? Okay, great. So first of all, thanks for all your work, Dr. Longo. You're amazing. Here's a question. Why can't humans use anti-appetite prescriptions like Phentermine to help with our fasts, especially if somebody's really obese and this is something that they're having a hard time handling? Does it maybe interfere with the pathways that lead to autophagy or mTOR, or is there a molecular issue that makes it harder and it doesn't work?
Yeah, I can tell you we just finished 2 trials, one on hypertension subjects and one on diabetic subjects. Most of the subjects were overweight or obese. We had very high compliance. And this was done both in Europe and the United States. In fact, one of the studies was done in Tennessee. I would say we're going back to what we just discussed with David about the poking a hole through a car. Some of these drugs are probably to be avoided. But I understand in some cases there may be no options, and so if there are no options, then drugs are okay, the right type of drugs. So I don't know enough about these appetite suppressing drugs to tell you can they interfere with the fasting. I think they just are probably to be avoided at all costs unless you really need them, right? So unless that's the only way that you're going to achieve the effects. I would say that's probably a safe way to go.
I really like that answer. Thank you. Cass, are you up for asking your question on the air?
Okay. I wondered, Mr. Longo or Dr. Longo, with regard to the COVID-19 vaccine that so many people are getting shots for currently, do you agree that this is the proper way to go? Are you going to get the vaccine, or do you already have it? If so, why? If not, why not? Thank you.
Yes, yes. So I'm vaccinated. I got two of the Pfizer vaccines. And the answer is obviously yes. Why? Because COVID-19 is a very scary virus. And that's the danger is really whatever minimal danger there is from the vaccine, there's a very big danger from the virus, even for younger people, but especially for those that are older. So there is really, if you look at the numbers, there is really no doubt about it. The sooner people get the vaccine, the quicker we be out of this, very historical moment. Yeah.
Do you have any concerns about the poking holes in a system sort of thing, where we haven't done this kind of vaccine before? And I by the way, I agree with your thing. There's definitely risks from the virus that are known and relatively large, not as large as Ebola by a long shot, but there's real risks and long term mast cell activation and things like that. There's less data about the vaccine, but the data we have says it's lower risk than the virus itself. But are you worried about the long-term aging effects of vaccines or anything like that? And this is not a pro or an anti-vax show. Yeah. It doesn't have to be polarized. It's a science show where we're curious.
No, I understand.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm very worried about any intervention, especially an intervention that is going after the immune system. Now, especially in an era where autoimmunities are everywhere and they're going up very, very rapidly. Not just autoimmunities, but also inflammatory diseases. So that's very unfortunate that we don't have an extra body of control that says, even if I give you a vaccine, and this could be the flu vaccine, right? Let's forget about COVID, but say, who's watching to make sure that whatever we get injected all the time are truly optimizing our health span? Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think that, the clinic in Los Angeles that we have, we call it L-SPAN medicine. Right? So our goal, whether it's a dietitian or a nutritionist or a physician, is to, I'm not treating you for what you have today. I'm treating you to make sure I optimize your chances to make it to 110 healthy. So I don't want to, and of course, with COVID, I have to also worry about you're going to make it to tomorrow. Right. So I can take more risk because this is really putting you in such a dangerous position that, having had, three or four FDA approvals related to this really minimizes the acute risk, but we still have an uncertainty and long-term risk. And that's just very unfortunate that the CDC, et cetera, are not looking at, what are the lifelong consequences of, let's say, the flu vaccine every year. And maybe they are, and if they are, that's good. But we like to hear more about it because if they are, nobody's ever heard that. I never heard a comment about this. Yeah.
Very well put, rational response. And I want everyone listening to the show, it's okay to choose to get vaccinated because you look at your risk profile. It's okay to say, I want to know, like there is no good or bad. We're all doing our best here. And so don't be judgy of people who choose to do something different than you. Like we're all working through it and and we're all making our best decisions. And this should not be a political thing. It is simply a question on the science thing. So I don't do polarization about that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And again, my purpose is to get people to 110 healthy, right? So
yeah.
Without worrying about the ideology behind it.
There you go. And we need a lot more thinking like yours in the world today. Another question is coming through, but I can't tell who it's from in the Upgrade Collective because of our interface here. Have you looked at using alpha-ketoglutarate, AKG, with vitamin C with yeast longevity? Is that a part of what you're doing? I've been seeing a lot of anti-aging about that as well. I actually prefer OKG to AKG, but have you looked at those pathways at all?
We are certainly looking at the pathways. We have never supplement alpha-ketoglutarate or anything like that. We try to be much more upstream, right? So because if you interfere with the cells at the level of some of these molecules, you may not get the full reprogramming effect. Right? So this is why we really like the growth hormone receptor, growth hormone level signaling. because it's what I call the master regulator. Well, of course, we now have people that we follow down in Ecuador. They have mutation in the growth hormone receptor. So it means like they're almost as if they had very little growth hormone activity as adults. And we show they have much less cancer, rarely develop diabetes. Cognitively, they're younger or much younger than you expect them to be. And now we're about to publish a new study on cardiovascular disease. And let's say that that's also not negative. So, yeah, I really like looking at these master regulators rather than looking down almost at the end. Alpha-ketoglutarate is really almost at the end of that pathway, right? So again, you know, it could be very good for one cell type. It could be very bad for another one. And sometimes it could be, let's say, feeding some cancer type cells and it could be killing some other cancer cells. So yeah, the focus on the evolutionary, on the pathways that have evolved for the purpose of changing longevity, is probably the best one.
Really, really good answer. So it sounds like more research is needed on that one. And a new study just came out in the last 2 weeks that showed arginine supplementation was actually causing more harm than good. So I'm going through that and writing it up. I don't know if you came across that yet, but I'll share that with the Upgrade Collective and I'll put it on my blog. So it also has some good sides with nitric oxide and things like that. But again, like you're saying with systems biology, you know, pros and cons, and maybe you should do it once a week, not every day. And it seems like for a lot of these things, it might be occasional interventions, just like with fasting, you don't have to do it every day. And
Where the, you know, I haven't looked at your pillars yet, but you know, that's where the multipolar approach comes in, right? So you want to say, is arginine supplementation for example, is it extending the lifespan of a mouse? Is it extending the lifespan of a rat? Is it people that have a lot of arginine in their diet, do they live longer? You know, what about arginine rich foods? What about the centenarians? Do they consume a lot of arginine rich food? That's what I think is a good way to put it together and say, do I do it or not? Right? Well, if 4 out of the 5 pillars are negative, you definitely don't want to do it. If let's say 1 is negative and 3 or 4 are positive, that's probably a much safer direction to follow. So I would assume if you look at arginine, there would be no data for most of these pillars, right? So you wouldn't be able to say, oh, arginine, so it'd be inconclusive that arginine consumption in the food is making people, is associated, say, with a longer lifespan or less disease. I would be surprised if you see pillar after pillar showing positive correlation with mortality or let's say negative correlation with mortality.
What are the top 5 supplements that you take or that you think are most helpful?
I take 2 supplements. And one is a multivitamin containing all the things that, and I take it every maybe 3 days or so. And the idea is to plug holes, right? So let's say that I'm becoming vitamin D deficient. And if you get this every 3 days or calcium deficient, it's probably going to plug that hole and make sure that I never develop a severe deficiency. And the other one I take, if I don't eat a lot of fatty fish, then it's the omega-3 fish oil. Those are the 2 that I feel pretty confident about. Yeah.
So you're taking vitamin D without vitamin K2. It's interesting. And any reason you don't add K2 to it?
Well, I think the supplement I take is already, I don't take vitamin D alone, right?
Oh, it's in your multivitamin.
So I think that, I think they're already in there. I'll assume they're already in there.
But yeah, make sure, because vitamin D without K2 tends to drive tissue calcification, which is not the direction we want to go. But when you have it with K2, it tends to keep the calcium in the bones, at least according to all the research I've done. So that's, I bet it's in there. I'm assuming you're taking a high-end multivitamin, so you should be fine.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Valter, thanks so much for your work in the world and academia and working on cracking the code of aging here. I think you're one of the greats in the field. I'm grateful you were on Bulletproof Radio. Grateful you shared those answers with the Upgrade Collective and just keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, thanks for having me and great questions. Yep. Great discussion.
If you guys liked today's episode, you know what to do. Well, try intermittent fasting at least some of the time. Seems like there's some pretty good evidence for that. Don't have to do it all the time. And join the mission to live way longer than you're supposed to. I think we can all do that. And it's a lot of fun working on it. Think about being a part of the Upgrade Collective because we're doing that together, ourupgradecollective.com. And you can find everything about Valter Longo's work by going to valterlongo.com, V-A-L-T-E-R, Longo, L-O-N-G-O.com. See you all in the next episode.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.